Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck nicks? What the fuckocrats? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. On the show today, I talked to the director, Greta Gerwig, the actor and director, Greta Gerwig, about her new film, Lady Bird. I'm happy that Greta's here today. I hope you feel all right. It has been a roller coaster, continues to be a roller coaster culturally and politically, and I find it exhausting, but I am trying to find some space where I can, be okay with the life that I've worked for and settled into. But man, it's hard. But I'll tell you, everything that's going on, I somehow or another has made me appreciate life a bit more. I always sort of took it for granted. You take life for granted. I'm living, and you sort of avoid your ultimate destiny any way that you can on a daily basis. But now I'm sort of like, it might happen. It's obviously going to happen, but it might happen. I've talked about this before. I feel like I'm being morose. I watched some comedy. I did some comedy. I'm trying to continue evolving my craft. I hope you all are as well. I hope you're trying to do the best you can do so you can at least feel good about that. I am in the garage. I am in between homes. I am, spending equal time almost at both places in a way, doing the work here at the Cat Ranch and doing the work at the other place. I was outdoors in front of my new house. I met the woman who is the head of the neighborhood watch. Yes, I met her and she introduced herself and then pointed out the homes of who lived in where and where the other neighborhood watch people and who her co-watch person was, Catty Corner, gave her my email. So I will be getting the coyote updates, the suspicious drifter updates, water main breaking updates, did anyone hear that updates? I haven't been on a neighborhood watch in a while. I had one. I was on one up here and it just got to be a bit much. I couldn't keep up and I was constantly looking out my window because there's always one or two people on the neighborhood watch, which it seems to be their life. That is their life. And you gotta pull out, man. I had to get out of that one. I had to get out of that loop. We'll see how the new loop goes. Sarah, the painter's on one and she gets updates about cats and coyotes and people breaking into cars. And it just, I got enough on my mind with the broad-based fear. I don't need to, there's the micro fears within, the macro fears from without, and then there's the just around the block fears that I guess they're probably more important than the larger ones, the umbrella fears that we all have because of what's happening in the world. But I don't know, trying to get past it, man. But I watched some comedy, that was the point. I'm trying to do the one thing that I've been doing all my life, that is the craft that I have honed with the most diligence. And see what I can do. See where I can take that. What do I got to do to challenge myself and make it exciting next? What do I got to do? So I watched, I do like watching comedy. I do find myself when I go to the comedy store, going in to see people and I just want to get a nice laugh. I could use a nice laugh. I appreciate getting a nice laugh. And not everybody can do it to me. Like last night, got a couple of Kyle Dunnigan laughs. He brought me up and he made me laugh a couple times. That was good. I think he was really the only one I watched for very long. But at home, I hooked up my television, and I guess every television comes with Netflix, and I watched some comedy. I watched Brian Regan's new special. I always like watching Brian Regan. I'm always going to get at least a few deep, solid kind of can't stop it laughter. And it was a good special. I enjoy watching Brian. And then I watched Jerry Seinfeld special. And I have to be honest with you, I have, I don't think I've ever watched him do stand-up, really, in terms of paying attention. I had, I decided that he really wasn't my thing a long time ago as a stand-up. I don't know. I do know why. I absolutely do know why. Obviously, I'm not taking anything away. I'm not going to criticize Jerry Seinfeld. He's done all right for himself as a stand-up. It was just never my bag. I never felt any depth to it. And I never felt that. Yeah, I never felt connected to it because I didn't know that I couldn't tell whether he was really connected to it. I thought it was, structurally fine, but I don't even think I paid that much attention till the other night when I watched his new special where he goes back to the comic strip and he talks a bit about his life. And then I think he was doing, classic bits that he did early on. But I watched the whole thing because I guess I'm in a space now where I can take it in and not be judgmental and just like, well, why don't you try to appreciate Jerry Seinfeld? I mean, it's never too late. People love this guy. Why don't you take it in? There's plenty of people that are peers of his that you like. There's plenty of people that show up in that special who I used to enjoy watching. Mark Schiff, who has been on this show, was one of Jerry's early friends. I always got a kick out of Mark. But I watched Jerry, and I saw what he does. I see what he does. I see the technique. I see the structure. I see the commitment to the script and to craft and to what it is exactly that Jerry Seinfeld does, how he builds a bit, how he sort of peppers it all with punchlines, and how he talks about things that you would never notice. And you don't know whether you're happy that he noticed them or not, but now you're going to notice them and maybe get a laugh in the future, I guess is the point. It's like, I would have never thought of that. Now I am thinking about it. And now next time I see that, maybe I'll get a little chuckle. And that's not nothing. That, helping people get through the day by, laughing at mundane bullshit is, certainly it's in the plus side. But he did say something very interesting that I found very revealing. And I think the fundamental difference, between whatever he does and whatever I do, again, I'm not comparing myself to him. He's had tremendous success as a stand-up. But I don't feel that him and I would get along, and I don't feel that he has any, that I'm on his radar. But whatever the case, he said something in the special. He said, I don't really care if people like me or not. I'm not concerned whether or not people like me. I just want them to like the joke, which is interesting, isn't it? Like, I imagine that I want people to like me. Obviously, I do. I don't think that's necessarily why I do stand up. I'm not one of those people that needs love up there. Like, I need to feel like I'm alive and present and in the moment and connecting with the audience. But I don't know that I'm looking for love, but I am looking to be seen. And by being seen, I mean, I want them to see who I am. And it seems to me that is the fundamental difference. Like if I do an observational bit, I'm going to put a little bit of me in there, whether it's my neurotic insanity or my, paralyzing dread and fear or my own sort of darkness or my own sort of, obsessive take on something. It is specifically mine. And that is, a big part of my stand-up. I think it's more important to me than the actual writing of the joke. So that is the fundamental difference. And that is what I always felt about him, is that I just could not figure out who the hell he was. And I'm not sure that was a good thing. It felt like, what's that guy hiding? What is that guy hiding behind all this talk of nuance, compulsive, observational nuance? What's behind that? And I guess you see it a little bit, but to me, that moment where he said, I don't care if people like me, which, I will extend to, I don't care if they know me. And a matter of fact, I'd rather they didn't. Just laugh at the joke and put it out there. It's like, that is the barrage that I put in front of me to protect myself from you. Now, I've used comedy to disarm people and to, I've done it defensively. I've done it embracingly. I've done it a lot of different ways. But the point being, in thinking about how I want to do it in the future, I've been experimenting with persistence and creating a sort of nonstop giggling. I'm into creating nonstop sort of like giggling in people. There are people that can do that. It's a very specific thing that comes from a persistence, usually through repetition, where you just sort of get a roll going and you just keep pushing it and pushing and pushing it. And I know I can do it, but you know, I don't do it consistently, and I don't do it necessarily on purpose. So I'm going to try to do that on purpose. Obviously, I'm not doing it here. I'm not doing it right now. I'm talking about doing it, right? So I saw The Disaster Artist, but maybe I'll talk about that Thursday when my guest James Franco joins us. But today on the show, I talked to Greta Gerwig, the director of Lady Bird. I've seen her in the Noah Baumbach movies. Why did I say that like that? I've seen her in the other movies she's been in. I've seen her in movies, but she directed this film Lady Bird with Saoirse Ronan. Is that her name? Come on. Yes, Saoirse Ronan. And I learned how to say her name from watching her monologue on SNL. But the movie Lady Bird is a coming of age teen movie about a teenage girl. And, you know, God knows that terrain has been explored and there are motifs and tropes. Yeah, and it's a genre in a way. I just want to drop some critical terms. But somehow or another, Greta really humanized and wrote a line with this film that was quite stunning. And Tracy Letts is the father, and Laurie Metcalf, both of them, you know, Steppenwolf geniuses. And Tracy playing he's actually the sort of slightly beaten down benevolent force, the sweet force in this movie, there's the father. But it takes place in Sacramento. I have some experience with Sacramento, having performed up there and having spent time in Sacramento. But ultimately this movie is a beautiful movie. It's a beautiful little movie about a teenage girl and her parents in Sacramento, you know, growing up, you know, about to finish high school. And it just, there's something so natural about it and something so stunning about the performances, and the direction was just right on the mark. It was really a great, great film. And I was excited to talk to her. I'm excited when I see a movie and it's great and I get to talk to the person. This is me and Greta.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Gerwig. How long have you been out here? You came out yesterday?
I've been out here. I was out here the week before. I'm kind of on a lot of planes right now.
Yeah.
So
how do you handle that? All right?
Mostly all right.
Do you freak out?
I have minor freakouts.
Oh, just on takeoff or landing?
Oh, no. I'm okay on planes now. I mean, it's sort of just like...
You mean just in life?
Yes, I thought we were just talking in general.
General freakouts here and there.
I've given over to planes.
Yeah, oh, good for you. You've surrendered.
Have you given over to planes?
You sort of have to after a certain point, unless you want to be exhausted every time you get someplace.
I know. I think
you really don't have control.
No, you have to kind of accept it because I think I had a moment where I was like, you can keep being nervous every time this happens,
sure.
Or you can just say, this is your life.
Sure. If this is the way it ends, this is the way it ends. I'd rather not.
Yeah.
I'd rather not picture it.
Right.
I tend to picture it.
I picture it.
Yeah.
I picture
just
it.
Just the
also,
terror, strangers screaming.
No. Please don't remind me. No, I did. A friend of mine though said something very comforting to me, which doesn't sound comforting, but was comforting.
Yeah.
My friend George said, yeah, but if you die in a plane crash, that would be awesome.
Oh, really?
And I said, why? And he said, well, everyone would say, Did you hear about Greta? How'd she die? Yeah. And they'd say, a plane crash.
She was on that plane.
She was on the plane. Oh, and I was like, yeah. I was like, that sounds terrible, but also I'm glad that my friend George thinks it sounds
he found it comforting.
Or he sort of thought it sounded, I don't know.
The one thing a guy said to me once that I found helpful was he said, you know, they're built to fly.
Yes. That doesn't comfort me.
No?
No.
They're not just sending them like, I hope this works.
Planes want to fly.
Yeah. Oh, you've heard that before.
I don't. For some reason, that doesn't.
But when you fly a lot, eventually you'll have that horrendous, terrifying flight that you judge.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
That kind of like breaks it open for you. Like you have a precedent.
Oh, please. I don't
want this. No, it's not the conversation we want.
I can't. I'm just so, I know it'll happen at some point. And I mean, just that something will happen. I'm just getting really
scared.
No,
you'll be fine. I'm just talking about turbulence. I'm not talking about the worst of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I saw the new movie.
Oh, yes.
I've seen you in other movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm familiar with you.
You're familiar with me.
I don't know everything. I haven't seen everything.
I'm so glad you haven't.
But I've seen enough.
Okay, good.
And I worked with Joe Swanberg a couple times.
Yes, that's right. Yes,
on
that's
his
right.
series Easy.
Right.
I've had Joe in here. I've had, I don't know if he's still your boyfriend, but I had Noah in here.
Yes.
We have common friends, I think. At least those two guys.
I know. I talked with Noah this morning.
He said
he really liked talking to you.
He did?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That was a while back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says he really, and he doesn't, he doesn't say that about everything.
Yeah, I think we connected. I think I got through. You know, he's like a New York guy.
Yes, yes, he's a New York guy.
I just saw his New York movie, his
Meyerowitz,
new New York, the Meyerowitz story.
It's great.
It is good.
Yeah.
I liked it. He got some pretty, painfully kind of angry performances out of a couple of funny dudes.
I know. I mean, all of the actors break my heart, but I don't know. There's this one line in it where Adam's saying, he says something like, we needed to believe he was a genius. Yeah. Otherwise he was just an asshole. Which I just, that's just the best line.
But isn't that true with all fathers? I mean, especially as a guy, like, you know, at some point, it all breaks down, but sort of, for a while, believe that your dad's pretty great. You know, it's sort of it's part of the rule book.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think as a not being a son to a father, I don't know that I totally ever quite understood that.
Yeah.
Intimately. I understand it kind of intellectually.
Well, the breakdown of that is pretty awful. As you grow older, whenever it happens where you realize, this guy's kind of...
I know.
You know,
I know.
Horrible.
It's all like mini death of a salesman happening all over the country.
Every day, at all times. Mini death of a salesman happens every 6 seconds in America.
Somebody's like, dad's a schmuck.
My dad's an asshole. But your movie seems very personal, this new movie.
It is, yeah.
And it seems like that dynamic between your mother, Laurie Metcalf, who's a genius.
Yeah.
And how do you pronounce the actress's name who played, I assume you?
Well, no, actually, it's so funny. The character she played, her name is Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse.
But actually, the Irish way to pronounce it is Saoirse.
Saoirse Ronan.
And I heard her explain that to Charlie Rose the other day because we were on Charlie Rose.
Yeah.
And then the whole interview, then I also called her Saoirse.
Saoirse.
And then she said, why did you just change the way you say my name? And I was like, well, I just felt like if Charlie was going to say it that way, I had to match it. And,
well, maybe she wasn't you, but she did a very good job.
Yeah, no. She was, it was funny. We actually have talked a lot about this, obviously making the movie, but now also doing press.
On the junket.
In a way, it was sort of the opposite of me. Like, I was not a... I mean, in the movie, for someone who doesn't know, she makes... Everybody call her by the name Lady Bird, and that's not her name.
Right.
I never made anyone do that. I never...
But what about the dynamic between the mother and... because that was very specific. That's sort of where we were coming off the father-son thing.
Yes. That, I mean, I definitely had a very complicated but very... rich, loving relationship with my mom that was just in teenage years, we just fought. And the thing is, I kind of remember the broad strokes of the fight, but I don't actually remember the details of a lot of the fights. I don't remember what exactly all the issues were, but I remember fighting.
But it's a very painful relationship, that one in the movie, because it's persistent and it's repetitive emotional dismissal and belittling and manipulation. The challenge is to find that character, to have empathy for that character, right?
Well,
but you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess I've always sort of seen that the character of the mother and the way the relationship is playing out is like, we're meeting them at this moment and it hasn't always been this way. And that even though it's bad right now.
Yeah. Right.
Still,
it's not forever.
Still within that context.
Yeah.
Her mom's still always helping her out.
Sure.
And making sure that everything is as good as it can be, even while she's completely frustrated and not sure that her daughter is ready for the world. And I think that that's the thing that makes it so understandable, is like, that still doing anything for her.
Right, but there's an emotional price to pay for a character like that, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
In the sense, and the fact that Saoirse, that her awareness of it, you know, in the film, that she knew that her mom had this problem. She didn't know what exactly it was, but she knew that as herself became more defined, that she was up against this. So it didn't feel, you know, all out, it didn't feel like emotional abuse for the whole...
Right.
Because she was struggling with her mom's persistence of belittling her, really.
Right. I think, too, it's like the thing, or I think of it about it, too, is like the dynamic of, to me, in some ways, the way I write is so, I allow myself to kind of do things unconsciously, and then I try to craft them after I've done it unconsciously. And the part that I...
What do you mean? You write, you stream of conscious, or you just sort of like blow it out, or like...
Not stream of consciousness, but I don't... I have the distinct experience of tapping into something where I can just write and write and write, and it doesn't feel like I am doing the choosing of the words, which I'm sure everyone who writes at some point feels like that. And then I come back to it later, and it's almost a sense of, I don't know who wrote this, and now I have to make it into something that has form.
That's good that you can do that.
It's good. It's good, but it's odd, and it doesn't doesn't make you. There's an odd disconnect with it.
Uh-huh.
Because in a way, it's like you've found something that someone's left.
Well, that's better than being sort of self-conscious about something you've done, like as it's happening. It's nice that you can kind of blurt it out wherever it comes from and then work with it, as opposed to sort of like over every sentence, like, oh, God.
Yeah. No, I can't. I there are moments where I just, once I start structuring those things and making them have more form, I have to then move it from A to B. And I do have some just teeth pulling moments of getting story down, but for the most part it comes out like that. And so in some ways I have this strange experience with a script of knowing that it works on the page, but also I have a certain amount of mystery to what I'm saying and how these characters function, and when I have great actors, they give me more understanding of what it is I've written, and that informs how I'm going to direct it. And there's just a scene where Saoirse is there. It's a bad moment, and she's trying to get her mom to talk to her, and her mom won't talk to her. And then all of a sudden, the character starts yelling at herself. She starts saying everything her mom has said, but her mom isn't even saying it. She's saying it, and I knew kind of that's what I had written, but the first time I saw Lori and Saoirse rehearse that scene, I was like, oh, that's the thing, is your parents don't even need to do it to you. You will do it to yourself.
That's the worst.
The rest of your life.
Right.
You will have those tapes playing forever.
And even if left to your own devices, if you want to create just out of necessity a parent in your mind that's different than the one you have, it's not going to give you a break either.
No. All the parents.
You're doomed.
It's true. But ultimately, I feel that why Lori and why, you know, that this relationship is something that you sympathize with and understand, even though you're frustrated with it, is that I think I see Lori as creating a character who, despite making mistakes and not doing everything perfectly, that she actually does give her enough good things, enough courage to go do what she needs to do.
Right.
So she didn't squash her.
Right. And there's also that weird, you know, the element, because it's really just a coming of age story, right? Is that what you would call about a teenager?
Well, I've always sort of, the way I looked at it, or like conceptually I looked at it, was like, I wanted it to be one person's coming of age is another person's letting go. And I wanted it to be with just as much attention on the letting go side of it as the coming of age side of it, which often I think movies about teenagers, the adults are just sort of played as jokes. Or,
oh, right. Just kind of like stereotypes.
Yeah. And especially with, like, not just parents, but then also teachers or other figures in their life. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wanted every person to feel like they're in their own story.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty amazing, you know, because I like seeing Tracy Letts do anything.
Me too.
And Lori Metcalf. So,
both,
like, it was pretty dynamic for me. And I love the movie. And I don't love all movies, but like I didn't know, like, you know, a lot of times I talk to people whose movies I thought were okay.
Yeah.
You know,
sure,
I try
to
find something nice to say, but like, you know, right when people start singing, I start crying. I don't know why, it just happens.
Singing. Me too.
Really?
That's why I love musicals.
I know. I don't even know what it is. I don't see a lot of them, but every time I watch, even when the kids were just singing, you know, when they were auditioning, I'm like, oh, good. I don't even know.
That's how I feel.
What do you think that is? Why?
Because it's
so vulnerable, right?
It's so vulnerable. It's so sincere. There's something about singing,
right,
particularly people singing who are not
great singers.
Great singers.
The kids were great.
You can't. I mean, there's nothing more just raw than that. And
yeah.
I still love going to see high school musicals when I'm home in Sacramento. I'll go see the local high schools put on musicals.
Do you sing?
I don't sing well, but I do.
You let yourself?
Yeah, I do. I let myself sing.
That's right. You sang in the you kind of were jumping around and rocking out in that movie with the Annette Bening.
Yeah, I did. But I really sang in, I sang in Greenberg.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that.
I sang a Judy Sill song in Greenberg.
Okay. Was that at a party or something? Where did it happen?
My character sort of wants to be a singer, and she invited Greenberg to go see her sing at the Silver Lake Lounge.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then
I'm remembering.
She sings that Judy Sill song.
So you do sing?
I do sing. I mean, I can carry a tune. I was in choir in high school.
Okay.
But I was always second soprano, so it's always, that's like, you don't get the melody, you get the harmony, so you're kind of singing the other thing, and it's it's just kind of like, you don't ever get to like soar.
Yeah, right. I was terrified of it, you know, and I like to sing, but I was terrified of it for so long.
Yeah. It's scary.
I don't know why, you know, it's just a matter of like, you don't think you're going to do it well, but people, if you do it, you know, honestly, people will respond if you're not horrible. And then even then, people are relatively sympathetic depending on the venue. And if you're not singing the national anthem.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I know. I think it's very appealing. And I've also always liked, you know, that my favorite musical theater singers have, in a way, peculiar voices.
Like who?
Well, like, you know, Elaine Stritch.
Oh, yeah.
Is.
Yeah.
It's not a straight-ahead, beautiful voice.
Right,
there's
right.
something else there. Even Bernadette Peters is...
Well, those two like are on the kind of cabaret-ish. I don't know a lot about musicals, but there's a, you know, there's a character to it.
There's a character to it. Elaine will like talk sing.
Yeah, yeah.
We actually, Saoirse and I talked about. She had when she sings Everybody Says Don't in the movie for her audition, there's an Elaine Stritch version of singing Everybody Says Don't, and she talks through the whole thing, and she kind of runs everything together, and Saoirse was sort of doing a version of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
She, it was great because the funny thing about that audition, and just in terms of who she is and what you're building that character into, is that she owned it so well, you thought for sure she'd get it, and she doesn't because the guy was like, all right,
you know,
you got a showboat here. She needs to be, you know, harnessed.
Yeah.
I mean, humbled.
She also is just, it's just too much. Everything's too much. That character is kind of living on the edge of a cliff always.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I love about her. But it's amazing to watch her fling herself at stuff.
And also you maintained a sort of innocence that, we've grown to think is no longer there.
Mm.
That, you know, the assumption is like, you know, these kids today, they've got access to everything. But this is 2002, right?
This is 2002.
So it's a little different.
A little different.
That's true. I just realized that as I was saying it.
I mean, one thing that I did on set, because, and I took this from Noah, it's something he does, and it's a great policy on set, is no one had any cell phones because I don't like cell phones on set, because if you need to make a phone call or text someone, you can leave set and go do it there. But there's nothing that bums you out more than looking over and seeing
everybody.
Everybody texting in between. And someone said to me, oh, good luck with that, with the younger kids in your cast. They're attached to their phones. And actually, I think for them, it was such a relief not to have to deal with their phones. Yeah. And that they loved it. They all left their phones in their trailer, and then they were totally present.
Because they had to.
They had to. But then they really enjoyed it. And I sort of I made them innocent again.
Yeah. Oh,
but
that's great.
I obviously there's like the internet giving you access to all kinds of things. But one thing is, yeah, everybody knows things all the time now. And I don't know.
But there is a context to childhood that you can't, like, you're not going to fill it up more than it can be filled up. Like,
yeah,
like,
that's true. That's true.
Do you know what I mean? Like, their range of interest and, you know, what they're going to take in and what they can take in is relative to the brain at that age, not to how much is out there.
Yes.
So that's
right.
What,
that's right. There's only just a certain amount. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
And so
I've never thought of it that way.
And so they maintain it, you know, naturally.
Naturally.
Because they're sort of like, I don't know what that is. I'm not...
Yeah.
I'm not going to deal with that.
I know. Although, I mean, I even remember, though, like, when I came to college, I went to college in New York, and I remember having this sense of, like, where did everybody hear about the cool stuff?
Right.
Like, I don't know. Actually literally don't know where you would have heard of that.
Yeah.
And, like, the guys who somehow at 18 already knew all the cool
Well, they were not in Sacramento.
Stuff. Yeah, and maybe they had more of a, I don't know how to...
There was definitely an exposure issue.
Yes, there was an exposure issue, which is less now because of the internet.
That's right, yeah.
And that thing of like getting information through magazines is something I kept trying to explain to the cast of like...
Oh, right.
When you would have won, that was where the cool stuff was.
Go
you
get,
got it?
Yeah, every month.
In the magazine. Right. And I always remember I had 17 magazine.
Yeah.
They would, obviously the people who made 17 magazine were people who lived in New York or uh-huh. LA and stuff, and they knew. But it was this disconnect between what clearly the editors knew about and then what we were hearing on the radio.
Yeah.
So there would be like this, you know, Bjork being really cool,
right?
But we never heard Bjork on the radio.
Yeah, where would you hear Bjork?
It was this sort of strange.
You'd have to go seek it out.
But
somewhere.
Like, I knew about Bjork from 17. Would do a sidebar on her,
right? Like, how do I access? How do I get that?
But like studying magazines. I mean, but I like that idea of sort of like this moment where all of this stuff is rising, but it's not there yet. It felt like, I mean, it's actually like, it's a little bit after when I was actually in high school, but it felt like a way to talk about now without actually having to shoot smartphones, which I didn't want to shoot at all.
Right. And also, you had a flip phone or two in there.
I have a couple kids had flip phones, but, and I just like that feeling of, I don't know, not knowing where someone is.
Yeah, I don't know how we did it. You know, it's a very weird thing how quickly and how effectively these technological conveniences have consumed our extensions. They're our extensions of ourselves. And that now the idea that you would come home at the end of the day and listen to your machine.
I know.
Let me just check my messages.
Let me check my messages.
Remember when you could check it on your phone with the tone? It's sort of like, wow, this is the greatest.
Yes.
I'm checking my messages my phone from my another phone.
I know. And you could see if anyone had called. It was something that we talked about a lot, even in terms of like production design, of like before everybody had a Pinterest page, and you know there was, you know, you would have the furniture that would be around you would be stuff that you would have gotten when you got married or from your grandmother, and then you know you could like Sears and Penney's, and maybe there's a Costco where you could buy a computer chair, but like the stuff that was around you, it was like pre-IKEA, like kind of design in the way that we experience design now.
Right. It's design's very accessible and completely turned out now. It's like everywhere.
Yes, everywhere.
But even, you know, like everyone celebrating Target. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and Sacramento also is this sort of this weird kind of, you know, a middle America city in California. I've been there several times. I dated a woman briefly for a few years from Sacramento.
Did you ever do stand up in Sacramento?
Sure. At the Punchline.
At the Punchline.
At the Arden Mall, across from the Arden. What is it?
Arden Fair Mall.
Is it Arden Fair? Sure. And I stayed at the horrible condos across from the Arden Fair Mall.
Yes.
And I wandered around that mall. I used to go up there fairly frequently to the Punchline. It's right next to the mattress store on the second floor of that strip mall there.
There's a number of comedians who come through Sacramento. I remember
my dad
was always interested in comedy. He always had like comedy albums and stuff, and he'd go see people who came through. And
well, it's a very healthy, that was a good club, and there was a very healthy comedy scene out of San Francisco that ran a lot of people through there, and all the major headliners would play Punchline Sacramento. It's a big room. You can make some money if you could sell some tickets.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be that 50s diner.
Yes.
Like right...
Yes,
right there in that strip mall.
Yeah,
then it went away, and I was sort of upset because it was open late.
This is all, and it's all right by the fairgrounds.
Yeah,
the state fairgrounds, which there's something about growing up in a place where like the state fair is like a really big deal.
Sure,
that it's even though Sacramento is the capital and it's a city, but it does have sort of a small town feeling, and that definitely connected to the agricultural roots of California, and it's in the Central Valley, of the agricultural valley, and just I remember so much. My childhood was like being excited for State Fair and then just loving State Fair and then being bummed that when it was done. But there's like, you know,
because they had the Midway and they had
serious livestock competitions. Kids would come in and they were like, I've raised this pig. I love my pig. And it was always exciting. And then there was also this thing of like if an animal was about to give birth, like a cow or a pig, it would be they'd put them in this area where you could just keep watch on them, and then you'd wait for hours and hours, and they're like, "It's coming!"
Really? Gather round.
You'd watch a cow give birth, and then this little cow would come out and just be so gooey but so cute, and like instantly start walking, and it was amazing.
It'd be like a 14-year-old with a cowboy hat on, and his boots with his dad dealing with shit.
Yeah, and there was also this thing, this amazing thing they had, the county exhibits. Yeah. It was like in one of those big expo rooms, and every county would make their own like life-size diorama, which was always I just loved it. And it was kind of, I don't know who judged the county exhibits, but I always, I always felt like LA did not put as much effort into it as they could have, given it was like...
That was supposed to be the creative.
Yeah, but they sort of just like had a California raisin and were like, we're done.
Sure, and every other county was like, we're going to beat LA.
Yeah, and it was like Yolo County. It was incredible. And like Mendocino County.
What were they, exhibits?
Yeah.
Representing the county? What the county represents?
Like what is it about the county? Like trout or... I don't know what that's all. I can think of is trout,
right.
Or you know the redwoods, or you know the, whatever the county in California was, and you know California is such a big state.
Huge. I grew up in Albuquerque, and they had the New Mexico State Fair, and it was kind of a big deal.
Yeah,
there was a bit of the rodeo business, but not a lot of agriculture. But there was also like indigenous people, like you'd go, and there was that whole area where you'd go get Indian fried bread and they had Indian jewelry.
Yes.
And then there was the Midway, and they had like the babies in a jar and the freak show and a couple of rides. Mm-hmm. And then there was the horses and the exhibition halls and then rodeos and concerts with Roy Clark and Buck Owens and Willie Nelson and
that sounds
George
like
Jones.
Fun.
I didn't do all that. But
you
I
didn't
I'm,
do all of
but
that.
We'd go to the fair.
You know, go to the fair.
Get the Indian fry bread.
We get the 2 week pass, like the so you could go to the fair every day.
Really?
Yeah, they had like this area called the farm where there'd be agricultural like there's always like a thing in Sacramento, particularly in Davis, like trying to create an avocado tree that will stay alive during the winter.
Yeah.
Because California, Northern California, the avocado trees will grow, but they will not produce avocado fruit because the winters it drops down to be too cold. So there's always like big avocado
problem, shortage.
Exhibits about trying to keep them warm and avocado trees wrapped in blankets.
Isn't it weird what makes an impression on you that you remembered that? That there was that this avocado problem, but the way it was illustrated is something you've held on to your entire life.
Yeah.
Because there was something about the device of warming the avocados that was ingenious to you.
Oh, no. I mean, the whole thing. Well, it's so funny because it's just like that where the comedy club was, where Arden Fair is, where the fairgrounds are. Yeah. All of that. I mean, the fair, it's just one of those things in my life where the state fair was such a magical kingdom to me when I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
And then as an adult, and when the state fair is not going on, fairgrounds don't look like anything.
No, they're
like nothing. It's impossible to explain why this was so meaningful.
No, they're like dormant and they're waiting.
They're waiting.
They're just sort of like, look, it's all going to be happening in a year.
I know.
But now nothing's going on there.
I know.
And there's always like one or two cars and you're like, what are those people doing there?
I know. I mean, maybe I'll make a movie that has the state fair in it because I had wanted to put a state fair in the movie, but it just didn't make it in. It had no place. It would just be completely unnecessary.
But you did. It was sort of a bit of a weird love letter to Sacramento.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it is. It's a love letter through the eyes of somebody who thinks she wants to get out, but that then looking back is like, oh no. That was my life.
I get a little choked up just thinking about that, you know, her what she said to her mother, the driving.
I know, it's a killer.
Yeah,
it's a killer. I think that's one of the things about particularly being a teenager is you just have this certainty that life is going on somewhere else, and you're just positive about it. And then you get to the place that for whatever reason you think life is, and then you think, oh no, this is not it.
Right.
It's not, wait, maybe it never happens.
Right, right.
Or maybe it's...
Did you feel that?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm trying to think. So did you have siblings?
Yeah, I have an older brother, older sister.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you grew up in Sacramento your whole life?
Whole life, yeah. My parents still live there. My brother lives there with his family. My sister lives in Berkeley with her family.
And what do they do?
My mother's retired.
She was a nurse?
She was a nurse. She was actually an OBGYN nurse.
Uh-huh.
And my dad works for a credit union.
Uh-huh.
He does small... I don't know how to explain his position. He does small business loans.
Uh-huh.
Like, he sort of vets them and finances.
So you kind of base these characters in the movie pretty close.
Pretty close, yeah.
Yeah. And what do your brothers do, your siblings?
My sister works for the EEOC of California, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And my brother is a landscape architect, but he does like sort of kind of like more large scale things. Like if you're going to build a freeway, how do you preserve the plant life?
Right.
That kind of thing.
Problem solving.
Not personal landscape architecture.
Right. Not like I really want a pond.
No. Okay. I mean, I think he can do that, but I think maybe he moved away from it. But
yeah. Why wouldn't you?
He drives a truck.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Trucks are good. Trucks are, yeah, Sacramento.
Yeah.
You get a truck. You got to have a truck if you're a landscape designer. Right?
Yeah.
A landscape architect.
He's driving out to sites.
So that's sort of a creative thing, but you went, you know, full on, like, I got to get out of here. I'm going to be an actress. What?
Well, yeah. Well, they all were creative. Like, my sister was, she was a really gifted artist and also a gifted writer. Uh-huh. She still writes.
Yeah.
But I decided to do it for my job, which I think was scary for everybody.
Everybody involved. Yeah.
Everybody involved.
Yeah, they're just, yeah, they're concerned. Like, it's weird to, it's hard to be a parent, I think, and not worry about somebody who wants to pursue the arts.
It feels like you're just letting your kids sign up for a disappointment forever. Well,
and that could be the way it goes.
Yeah, it's true. I'm qualified to do some things because my mom was worried that I would not have a, but when I was a teenager, I became a certified step aerobics instructor and also a certified paralegal.
You
so
did?
That, yeah, so that I could have.
Because your mom was like, you got to have something to fall back
gotta
on.
Got to have a trade. And step aerobics was kind of a big deal at that moment. So I'm one of the, I think, youngest step aerobics
really?
Instructors.
Did you get a plaque? Do you have a plaque? From?
I got a certificate, you know.
How old are you?
16.
So you're 16 and you're just sort of standing in front of a room full of, I imagine, women.
Yeah.
Doing the step aerobics.
Doing some step aerobics. It's
being
just
chipper
a lot of choreography.
Sure.
You know?
It's a performance.
Yeah, definitely. And
and what does a paralegal do exactly?
Well, I never actually did it, but I did, but I took the class at Sacramento City College to get certified, but I never was hired as a paralegal. But it was a lot. I think it's a lot of stuff where you sort of have to know you are not authorized to make contracts,
right.
But you know about the law enough that you can look for cases to support things. I'm making this up at this point.
They know a lot about the law and they can organize things for the lawyers.
That's right. That's right. I think I remember someone telling her that if I didn't technically need a certificate, but I had a certificate.
Well, good. So, and you still have that. That's good. I don't know. Do you refresh it every year just in case?
No. I should. Just in case
this dream
doesn't
ends.
Work out. But yeah, I mean, your family must have also been like a little.
I guess, you know, I don't know. I think they were all pretty self-involved. There wasn't a lot of. You know, they're just sort of like, he seems like he's doing all right.
He seems okay.
Yeah, he seems to be confident. Let him go ahead and do this.
Yes.
Whatever the hell he's doing. But yeah, it took a long time for it to work out. I think they were worried, but what good is that going to do anybody? They can't forbid you. They can. Are they going to forbid you out of their own fear?
Right.
Which I think the mother character does a bit of in a way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess you could forbid, you could sort of say, I'm not, if you're going to, like, now we won't, you know.
Support you. Like, you know, you're on your own.
You're on your own.
Well, thank God you have your paralegal license and you can be a step instructor.
That's right.
And when you go to New York.
Yeah, when you go to New York. Yeah, yeah.
And all that talk at UC Davis. Like, I've performed at UC Davis, too. Mm.
UC Davis, I mean, my brother went there.
It's a good school, I think, as far as the state schools go.
It's a very good school.
Yeah.
It's just that it was close.
Right.
That was the essence of her complaint, is that it's close.
You're not far away.
It's too close. Someone could drop in on you.
It's so funny that you handled, like, you know, there were those tropes of these kind of movies.
Yeah.
But you did them, like you said, you went a little more in depth, because I do think that they're real events in teenage life.
They are.
And you know, it is easy to sort of, you know, make them hacky. And you did not do that.
I tried not to.
No, it was great. It was very touching. The old best friend, the real best friend, and the shitty new best friend.
Yeah.
And the lying, the shame of this girl and her mother, and it was all class shame.
Yeah, there's a lot of class shame.
Yeah, and so you leave Sacramento after doing your paralegal classes, and you got into Columbia?
Yeah, or at Barnard College.
You got into Barnard?
Yeah. And I was at Barnard.
Did it work the way it did in the movie, where you got some loan or scholarship, or how'd it go?
Yeah, there was like a combination of things that enabled me to go to Barnard, which I eventually, I remember there was a moment in my mid-20s when I was able to pay off a lot of it all at once, and it felt amazing.
Did you get it all paid off now?
It's all paid off, and yeah, it was the best feeling of my life.
So good,
it was,
right?
Yeah, I'm so grateful that certain breaks happened for me and that I was able to do that, because it really is a crushing feeling. It
hangs over you.
It does. Did you have that experience?
No, I did not. My parents had a little bread.
Yeah.
But the house, this was my first house. Mm. And in when I got it, there was no way I was going to pay it off.
Yeah, I know.
And then like at some point, I'm like, I'm going to pay it off.
I know. Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
That's, you know, somebody, a friend of mine just bought an apartment, said, oh, I've just bought a lot of debt. And I thought, oh, that's true. It yeah. is that.
Yeah, you don't feel like you really own it. And then no. when you really do own it, you're like, all right, so it's mine. Now what?
Now what?
Yeah.
I know.
But so what do you study at Barnard?
I did. I eventually majored in English literature and philosophy.
What was the focus in English lit? Did they make you focus on a period?
Yeah, I was really into sort of Renaissance and medieval studies stuff. I really liked...
Oh, yeah? Like the Canterbury Tales?
But I was really into...
It's my one reference.
Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah.
And Milton and
other... Yeah, that's good. Milton's good.
Renaissance dramatists.
Yeah.
And then I had a great... I had a lot of great professors who kind of blew my mind.
That's what they're supposed to do.
And I didn't have a chip on my... I think sometimes... Some of the people I knew who came to college had gone to the sort of high school that gave them what college gave me.
Yeah.
And so they were bored by college. But I had not heard of any of this, and I was thrilled.
Right. Like, where am I?
I was like, Nietzsche, shut up. This is crazy. I was reading it for the first time.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is great.
Yeah.
Or, you know...
Yeah,
Foucault,
who was this guy, right?
Like any of those guys who just sort of like burst the world open.
Could you wrap your brain around it?
Yes, I still remember having that feeling of satisfaction when something that felt impenetrable clicks into place.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I remember struggling with texts and then going into class and feeling like I had a hunch of what it was about, and then it was confirmed for me. But that it's a very, I think if you've ever had that satisfaction of struggling with something and then having it suddenly make sense to you.
Just open up.
It's a thing you look for continually in your
life.
Yeah,
I've had it with poetry. I've had it with some, you know,
yes.
some things. I don't know if I've had it a lot, but it sounds similar to your writing process.
It is. That's true. And I think it also... I remember talking to a professor that I who was very wonderful, who taught Lacan, philosopher.
Yeah.
And I remember going to her office hours once, and I was just struck. He has all these sort of equations, which yeah. were I didn't totally understand. And I remember asking her, she was French. I said, "Why Lacan? Why is Lacan your person?" And she said, "Because it is difficult." And I thought, that's a really good answer, because if you're going to spend all your life working on yeah. something, it's nice that it be difficult.
Right, and it keep revealing itself.
Yeah.
You never quite get to the bottom of it.
And that's how I feel. I mean, filmmaking yeah. feels that way.
I think that's
it's
right.
It's difficult.
Yeah, I
and
like
you,
this.
You never, you won't run out of ways to improve, and you will never get on top of it.
Right, but also, you know, it's still your form of expression. So, like, instead of thinking about improving or getting on top of, like, you can, like, surprise yourself
yes.
with the writing.
Yes.
And
right.
you're like, oh, my God. Like, I guess that's why I do comedy. It's a little more immediate. But certainly there's discovery, constant discovery.
Yeah.
You know, that happens on stage, in the moment, in conversation.
Yeah.
Where it's sort of like, I wonder if I can get that to work again.
That's right. That's right. And I think too, I've never done comedy like the way you do, like stand up or anything
yeah.
like that. But I've always really loved listening to comedians talk, and I like comedians a lot because it's that high altitude learning.
Yeah.
You never learn anything faster in your life.
Yeah.
Because it's the stakes are so high, and I feel like there's something about that that I...
The stakes are high, relatively.
High-ish. Yeah. But they're high because it's your ego.
Sure, right, right. It's not like, if we don't pull this off, a lot of people are going to die.
No. It's high altitude inside yourself.
Oh, no, absolutely. Because failure is imminent.
Yeah. And then it's like yourself can crumble in front of you, publicly.
Sure, right away. Like right away.
Instantly.
But part of the job is getting numb to that.
Yes,
and moving
right.
through that and just taking the hit. Like I thought about that even last night. I did a set at the Comedy Store and it was, the audience was demanding and they were there. They meant business, you know, and sometimes on a Wednesday night, I don't necessarily mean business for 15 minutes, you know, I kind of want to fucking just be loose.
Right.
But there was a moment there where there were these loud, drunk people talking right there. And I'm like, you know, I knew this was good. I said to him, I said, I knew you're going to be a problem. I had an instinct about it because I've been doing this a long time. Yeah. And they gave me stink eye and I felt it there. And I just focused in on an audience that was sort of like, all right, so you shut them up. Now what? I felt that menace. And then I realized, like, I'm a professional. And if they don't fucking laugh, I don't really, whatever.
Wow.
No, it'll come around.
Yeah,
I know this shit's funny. So like, if I'm going to take a hit for, you know, schooling those drunks, fine.
Right. That's amazing.
Professional. It's a professionalism that, you know, you have it too in what you do.
Well, I remember reading, that Born Standing Up, when he talks about kind of failing and failing.
Is that Steve Martin?
Yeah.
I didn't read it, yeah.
Oh, well, he has this, that thing about talking about how you sort of get this armor.
Yeah.
And they know they can't touch you anymore.
Right.
Because
it's a great feeling.
You have seen the worst.
That's a great feeling.
I mean, I think in a way, actually, for me, it's not that, I mean, I still have the ability to, you know, I'm still can be, you know, sensitive about stuff I've made, but I think because I've acted and written and made stuff for a long time, I've learned to not be quite so invested in the moment of whatever is going on.
Yeah,
because either way it'll go away.
Yeah, but I mean, film stays.
The film will stay around, but the feeling of like, I have gotten bad reviews. Like, you get used to it.
Yeah, I mean, fuck it, man. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, and then you just sort of learn from it and you move on. And a lot of times in what you do, if you're not at the helm, you know, it's not on you necessarily.
That's true, but this one is.
No, this one is, right,
this
sure. But
is.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, you know, there are projects I would imagine as an actor where you're like, yeah, the movie's okay, but I think I did pretty good, you know. But,
right.
But you, like, you sort of came up through this, you know, a world of, you know, I mean, Swanberg's world, Duplass world.
That's
you know, I don't know, like, it seemed like there was a great deal of effort put on certain outlets to make it a separate world of film, but it is just a variety of independent film, right?
Right.
It's stylized and improvised a lot of it, but it is still, it is like, I don't know who the mumblecore people are, what that means really.
Neither do I.
But you know, there are certain people that are like, Swanberg's great at it.
He has a way of doing it, and
it's
developed.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
To the way that he directs, you know, in the moment to, you know, because, you know, you're given, because I've done two episodes of Easy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you're literally writing with him.
Yes, that's right.
But the way he has to conceive of how these shots fit together in his head to make the thing function, you know, continuity-wise, is sort of fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
How many movies did you do with him?
We did two movies together. Yeah. We did Hannah Takes the Stairs and Takes the Stairs and Nights and Weekends.
Right.
And that very kind of real commitment to improvisation as the organizing principle of it. That was he was the most extreme version of that. Like the Duplass brothers, they did a lot of improvisation, but it was still more structured than what Swanberg was doing.
Well, the thing about Swanberg is sort of like, you know, he's discovering the fucking story.
Yes. It's happening.
Yeah.
It's happening.
And that's ballsy.
Yes.
You know, and then you realize like, well, a lot of this is on me.
Yeah. It's on you. In a way, I always said it was a way I could write while I was acting.
Yeah.
And that was part of the task.
Did you do any training in acting? after your philosophy in English?
I mean, this is the full story is it's really hard. I've done a lot of different things. So I didn't major in theater, but I did a lot of acting.
Sure.
And I did a lot of playwriting, and particularly playwriting in college. But we were very lucky at Barnard and Columbia, both of us together. We had a lot of Juilliard professors who were teaching in our drama department. So all of the main acting instructors from Juilliard were also teaching classes to us. So I had the benefit of these
resources,
really great acting teachers. And they were the first ones who said to me, you should take a playwriting class. You seem to be really interested in writing, because I was sort of writing my own monologues and stuff. And then so I started taking writing classes from these Juilliard writing teachers. And so I was doing, like, you know, whatever, an entire semester on Chekhov or an entire semester on Shakespeare with acting. And then I was also taking playwriting classes. And then I was also doing a lot of there's a show at Columbia called The Varsity Show, which is the show to be part of. It's all the cool comedy kids do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an original musical written and performed every year. I remember I showed it to a boyfriend who had not been at school with me after.
Yeah.
And he said, whoa, you guys put a lot of effort into this. And I said, we certainly did. But that was, you know, a big part of my experience too. But I wanted to be a playwright, and then I got rejected from
Yale,
NYU, and Juilliard playwriting for graduate school. And then I had already sort of started working on these movies, and I had also, as a sidebar, fallen in love with cinema, which I hadn't really been exposed to as an art form until I was in college. So I wasn't making a living making those movies with Joe or the Duplass brothers, and I had no idea how this was all going to, like, really shake out over time.
Uh-huh.
But it became almost like a film school for me, and in a way I found,
on all levels, as an actor, as a writer,
everything.
And as a director,
and also just as a how, like what you were saying before, like, how are they constructed? Do you need an extra shot between this and this?
Yeah.
Because it was also, everyone was editing at night.
Yeah.
So Joe would edit at night, but also when I shot with the Duplass brothers, their editor, Jay Doobie, would work at night. And then we would come back the next day and realize we needed some connective tissue between this thing or that thing. And it was so that was a big part of learning how stuff was put together. And then, but I had never really lost my taste for something that was quite written and something that felt like a piece of writing that existed that you were trying to work on that was outside of improvisation. And then when I read, I was writing already, but then when I read the script for Greenberg, which I auditioned for, I thought, that's it. This is the kind of...
You know, you can write this thing that these guys are kind of noodling with.
I wanted to do that. And
right.
I knew I loved Noah's other films.
Yeah.
But then when I read that, it was a feeling that I got a couple of times with different writers where I thought, I didn't write that, but boy, do I wish I had.
Sure.
I felt that way when I read Kenneth Lonergan's plays for the first time, Willino, when I read his plays. I had that very strongly. There are people whose genius eludes me until I see it on stage. Like, I felt that way about this playwright, Carol Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand until I saw it. And then I was like, oh.
I have a hard time with scripts in general, like really picturing them properly.
It can be hard.
It's some people can just do it. Like, for me, I don't, it's like, I end up not paying attention to direction.
Right.
So I just go voice to voice, and then I start to, like, I can't, it's hard for me to conceive of what's happening.
I think when I read Greenberg it was the first time I had read a film script that felt like piece of writing that I could understand just fully as a piece of writing.
And also because it's like, generationally, it's not far away from you.
It's not far away from me. And it's also, he takes time with the
character
stage directions.
Yeah.
Everything's beautiful. It reads like a very
so that
long
was a mind blower
poem.
You're right.
I mean, and then obviously we ultimately ended up writing together, and that was such a fun experience. And
with
I
what Frances Ha?
That was the first one we wrote together,
right?
And then we wrote Mistress America together.
Yeah, I saw Frances Ha, the black and white one.
That's right.
Yeah, I like that. You were good in that.
I think I like
that movie. And I liked Greenberg a lot because I knew the guy, and yeah, there it was familiar to me. You know, like it seems like Noah is, you know, he comes from a sophisticated background, and you know the way he creates characters is from a very kind of intellectually informed place.
Yes.
And but you know, but he's very sensitive to emotions and to broken Jews, I think.
I mean, he pays attention, and he's very he's also just a beautiful. Again, he's just a beautiful writer. In a way, he could have been a novelist.
Yeah, I could see that.
I could see him being a novelist as well. Even though he's a great filmmaker. So, but
I think what's interesting too is obviously they're not talking about you directing yet, but the fact that you've become a better actress, I think.
Definitely.
Over the arc of things, because even in Jackie, I mean, that was a very controlled role, right?
Yes, it was very controlled. I mean, part of it is, what are you being asked to do? And sometimes you're not asked to do something that's terribly different from what you've done.
Right.
But I have definitely become a better actress.
Yeah.
But I've always felt, for me, everything's gone together. Like, I started...
You weren't bad, but you were like... No. You, the varieties of yourself were apparent, whereas with Jackie and with 20th Century Woman, that there was a kind of control.
Definitely. And also, I think... I mean, that's always how... For me, I felt like I became a writer because... I was acting great writing.
Yeah.
And then the acting made me a better writer. And then that all made me kind of have a different eye on directing. And I feel like I've never been a person who just exists in one lane, mm-hmm. and they all support each other.
Sure.
They don't operate independently. I remember listening to, I felt a lot of kinship with, Mike Nichols, because he had been a performer and then a director. Mm-hmm. You know, he has this sort of trajectory, and the way he talked about coming at directing and then sort of using his background as a performer, as a, you know, comedy writer, and then other performing, like, I understood that.
Sure. Like the way you put together the sort of the learning process of working with Swanberg, working with the Duplasses, doing parts in those movies where, you know, everybody, you know, is sort of equal pay, equal work. You know what I mean? Like there's an ensemble of kind of like low budgetness and kindred spirits in terms of, you know, wanting to do something new generationally, but then kind of like moving into the bigger time and taking, you know, but what I'm saying is I could see how it all built your brain, going back to keeping the avocados warm, that you're, you know, an integrator of information.
I'm an integrator. I remember taking a personality test once. It's based on this Jungian typology, like that you have I'm an ENFP. That makes me sound like...
It's not, you're not an Enneagram, no.
No, it's like there's 16 different types, because for every category, you can be I or an E, which is an introvert or an extrovert. And anyway, under my thing, I remember it saying, like, they often see everything as part of a cosmic whole, which is, I do. I almost feel like that's... my brain needs to do that.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, the fact that you don't choose to... Well, I don't know if that's true, though, but I mean, like, that would be the same kind of brain that would believe in God.
That is the exact brain that would believe in God.
And, well, how do you feel about that?
I'm a theist.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You're okay with it?
I don't know. I don't subscribe to. I'm very interested in religion, and I'm interested in all different kinds of religion, uh-huh. but I don't subscribe to one. But I have some belief.
Faith?
I have some faith. But actually, I was listening to something the other day that said they were sort of saying like, oh, it was on This American Life. It was like all these things we don't know. Uh-huh. And they said, oh, you know, how many people believe the Earth orbits the sun? And everybody raises their hand. And then they said, and what is your evidence for that? Huh. Nobody has. I mean, can you tell me the evidence right now?
We don't. Some people told me at some point in time that scientists
right.
kind of got some closure on
there
that.
There is evidence. We believe there's evidence. We don't know what the evidence is.
Well, I mean, it's there. You can.
Right. It's there, but I bet it's harder to understand than you think.
Yeah, but I mean, that's not my job.
No, but meaning that's, but with, you know, there's a lot of things we just sort of.
Sure. I know. Like there is sort of an amazing, the amazingness of how it all holds together. Why, how,
it is.
You know, why is it okay?
Yeah,
you know, and certainly, you know, given the administration we're within that you start to feel existentially threatened of these things that we've grown to rely upon, then you start to really kind of go like, you know, is this the order going to be, are we going to live through it? Are we going to see
know.
The end thing? But no, I didn't want to be negative, but it is interesting that you take for granted a lot of things, I think is what you're
saying. You do. I mean, I don't know. I don't have any, I have absolutely no answers. I don't even really have convictions. I just kind of have a feeling.
You just see, you just feel that, you know, it's eventually kind of connected.
I think, there's this, in being and nothingness, it starts with a question, why is there something rather than nothing?
Well, don't tell me you got through that book.
No, of course not.
Okay.
But I definitely read the first sentence.
Yeah.
Which is supposed to put us in the frame of mind of why is there something rather than nothing, which is a really good question.
Oh, I couldn't. I have that book up there still, I think.
There's a great book called Reality Is Not What It Seems by this physicist Carlo Rovelli.
Yeah.
And I think I have it in my backpack.
It's so good that you do. Like, I like what you said about. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that he's just explained. He sort of he chronologically takes you through what we know, what physicists know about the origin of what's all this stuff, what's going on with time, and he takes us through like figuring out different things and figuring out what is the universe constructed of and how does it fit together, and it's sort of through the present moment and it gets crazier and crazier, and sort of like Einstein's three sphere, which just you can't even, if you try to think of what that is, your brain will stop functioning. But there's something about it that instead of making me feel like, oh, and we figured it out, it makes me feel very in awe of everything.
Sure.
And I think that sort of that awe feeling is, I don't know, it's almost like it's increased the more that I'm confronted with fact, that it's not diminished.
Well, that's good. You don't get the sense sort of like, glad that's figured out, now I can eat.
No, right. There's something that's, I remember, I forget what it was. I think it was when I was taking Enlightenment literature, but it was like, there's some amazing letter from like by the British Philosophical Society or maybe scientific, but there was some letter where they said publicly, I think we've almost figured it all out, which is just my favorite thing.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah, and they're like, I think we're just maybe 2 weeks away. It was something
when was that written?
It was like 1887.
Oh, they were on it.
You know?
Yeah.
And they were like, I think it's almost over.
Everything, nothing to worry about anymore.
But I'm very compelled by that confidence, and there's something so sweet about it that I just think
that, maybe that's your next movie on those guys.
Yeah, how lovely we are. We thought, yeah, I think it's about done.
Yeah, yeah, it's in the bag. We got it. Well, like I did have this weird question, like a meeting in Noah's Meyerowitz stories. The one thing that stood out to me was that, you know, how he left scenes, like, and then I'm just comparing the conversation that the way you ended. Lady Bird was similar, and it has something to do with that. There is no closure, and there's something about that. You're not saying that this story has a...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, to speak, I like movies where I was very careful about the very end of it. It cuts off on an inhale.
Yeah.
Because to me, and I looked through this footage a lot, the minute she exhales, there's something on her face that she's in a new story. And we're not telling that story.
Huh.
That is the end of that story. And I've always liked the end of movies where you feel retrospectively, oh my God, that was the end of that story. And I like it when it cuts off just as it ends and it lets you remember that that was the end. You know, in a way, I feel like so much of filmmaking, you know, if you've written it and you've directed it, it has to make sense to you. Because there's no other reason to make it. I mean, it has to fit your weird need in some way. And because that's the hunch that everybody else is going off of. That's the thing that everyone else is bringing their talents to and collaborating with. And even the structure of the movie and certain things that if people said, oh, does it need to be this way? One of the good reasons about like putting together a movie is it forces you to consider everything because it's all takes time and money and do you really need it? And
and
you get very real with yourself very fast about what you need.
Sure, you got for budgetary reasons you got to get lean.
Yeah. And then but then what's great about it is you realize that the things that matter that you need that you absolutely need, you'll probably develop more intellectualized reasons for later, but in the moment, you just know you need them and you don't question it.
Right.
Because if you start questioning it, then it all goes out the window.
Right.
Because I'm not making movies about, you know, I'm not making a crime caper. It's not like I need to know this information to know how they broke into the safe. It's more subtle than that. But if I lose track of it, then we're all lost because there's no reason to make this anything.
You know? Yeah, then it's just darkness and hopelessness.
But, yeah.
Thank God.
Why is there something rather than nothing?
You don't want to live there.
No. I think maybe I'm getting like this because this marble I'm looking into has a very cosmic...
The giant marble. The giant cosmic marble.
Cosmic marble. And I think maybe that's putting me into a particular headspace.
All right. Well, we can stop. It was great talking to you.
So nice talking to you.
Go see Lady Bird. It's open across the country. It's a beautiful movie, elevating the human spirit. That's the best we can do right now in our individual ways. Elevate the human spirit. Make it important. Make it vital. Make it worth it. Yeah, okay? All right, I'm going to play some dark, elevating guitar, slightly psychedelic, but with the three-chord progression that is hypnotizing and relieving to me, and at this point, tedious, but in a good way. Boomer lives.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.